Ekatra Foundation presents the Ekatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling something, well, monumental.
We really are. It's the Last Lion trilogy, William Manchester's epic biography of Winston Churchill, finished by Paul Reed. We're talking nearly 3,000 pages.
An absolute beast of a work. And our mission for you listening is to boil that down. We want to get to the heart of how Churchill, this incredibly complex figure, became who he was.
Exactly. The core idea for Manchester and Reed is fascinating. They argue Churchill wasn't great despite his flaws and failures.
Right.
He was great because of them. His whole life, all the setbacks, the isolation, it was all preparation.
Preparation for that moment in 1940. How does a man seen as, you know, a bit of a relic become indispensable leader? That's what we're digging into.
Let's start at the beginning then. Blenheim Palace. High nobility. Descendant of the Duke of Marlborough. You can't get much more privileged.
Seems like the perfect start, but the books paint a different picture underneath, don't they?
They really do. Manchester calls it a gilded cage. Outwardly splendid, but inwardly quite lonely. His father, Lord Randolph, was distant, often disapproving.
And his mother, Jenny, a vibrant figure, but maybe not the most attentive parent.
Very much absorbed in her own world, yeah. Mm-hmm. The authors argue this emotional distance, this neglect, created a kind of bottomless hunger in Churchill.
A hunger for what? Recognition? Approval?
Exactly. A lifelong, almost desperate need to prove himself, especially, you feel, to the memory of the father who dismissed him. It drove everything.
So that drive is there, but his cool days were, well, not exactly stellar. Harrow, Sandhurst. He wasn't seen as university material.
No, he wasn't. His mind didn't really fit the standard academic mold of the time. But here's the fascinating bit. His real education was what he gave himself.
You mean later in India?
Precisely. As a young army officer, bored, restless, he just devoured books. Gibbon, Macaulay, Darwin. He read voraciously, built his own intellectual foundation. It was sheer willpower.
Wow. So he literally constructed the intellect he needed. That energy then fuels this career of, well, incredible highs and lows.
Extremes, definitely. Think about the Boer War, 1899. His escape.
Oh, it's pure Hollywood, isn't it? War correspondent, captured defending a train, escapes across hundreds of miles of enemy territory.
It absolutely captivated the public. Instant fame. Manchester calls it the foundational myth of his career. It's what launched him into politics at just 25.
An incredible start. But then the pendulum swings. Fast forward to 1915, World War I. He's First Lord of the Admiralty.
And he champions the Gallipoli campaign, the Dardanelles. Strategically, maybe it made sense on paper, break the stalemate.
But the execution.
A disaster. A bloody disaster, as the book says. Hundreds of thousands of casualties. And Churchill got the blame. Utterly.
Stripped of his office, politically exiled, it could have been the end.
For most people, it probably would have been. But this is Churchill. What does he do? He gets a commission, goes to the Western Front to command a battalion.
That's extraordinary. From the top office planning the strategy to the trenches with the men.
It's incredible, isn't it? He needed to regain his honor, maybe prove something to himself too. And he learned the human cost of war in a way few leaders ever do. That experience was tempering.
Essential preparation, you could say, for what came later.
Yeah.
Which brings us to the next big failure, the 1930s, the wilderness years.
Right. This is the focus of the second volume, Alone. By this point, he's politically marginalized, seen as out of touch, a dinosaur.
Why? Because of his views on India, the empire.
Partly that, yes. But mainly because he kept warning loudly and insistently about the threat from Nazi Germany. Well, the government, under Chamberlain, was pursuing appeasement.
He was the Cassandra figure. No one wanted to listen.
Exactly. But his time out of office at his home Chartwell wasn't idle. He was writing, painting, securing his finances. But crucially, he was gathering intelligence, studying Germany, speaking out.
A productive exile, you called it.
That's it. He was free from the constraints of government, free to see the unpopular truth. He saw Hitler not just as a politician, but through this deep historical lens. He saw the pattern of tyranny.
So his isolation forced him to rely on his own judgment.
And build his case meticulously. So when war finally came, and appeasement was obviously a catastrophic failure, well, who else was there?
The man who'd been right all along, even when it made him unpopular, his political failure suddenly became his greatest strength.
Which leads us to May 1940. Destiny arrives. Chamberlain's out, Churchill's in, age 65. France is collapsing. Britain's alone.
The situation is beyond desperate. Invasion seems imminent. What does he bring immediately?
Honesty, first off. That famous line, "I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. No illusions."
But coupled with this, incredible defiance.
Absolutely. After Dunkirk, which was a military evacuation, a retreat, he frames it almost as a victory of the spirit. We shall never surrender. He weaponized the English language.
His secret weapon, you said earlier, language and history.
Yes. He understood the power of narrative, of morale, and his historical perspective gave him that clarity about Hitler seeing him as another Napoleon, another would-be conqueror of Europe. It informed his strategy.
And the sheer force of his personality comes through, too. Those anecdotes about him working from the bath, dictating constantly. Relentless.
Total command. But, you know, the books are clear. We have to acknowledge the other side, too. He wasn't a plaster saint.
No. The controversies are significant. His views on India and Gandhi, the Tony Pandy incident, the bombing of Dresden, these are deeply troubling aspects from a modern perspective.
And it's important not to gloss over them. He was a product of his time, his class, his empire. An imperfect hero. The value of the biography is showing the whole complex person.
Part of that complexity is his lifelong struggle with depression, his black dog.
Yes. It's quite moving, actually, to read about how he battled it. He didn't hide from it or try to cure it in a modern sense.
How did he manage it, especially under such immense pressure?
Manchester suggests he channeled it. He used those periods of darkness, that melancholy, and turned them into furious bursts of activity. Writing, painting, politics. He fought the darkness with action.
So he harnessed his own internal struggle, turned it into resilience.
In a way, yes. He understood despair intimately, which perhaps made him better equipped to lead a nation through its own darkest hour. Strength from acknowledging weakness, not denying it.
And that resilience shines through again, right at the end of the war, victory, and then...
He gets voted out of office, yeah. 1945. A stunning defeat. The country he saved decides it wants someone else to lead the peace.
Incredible. How did he react?
He was wounded, no doubt. But he didn't just disappear. He immediately began reinventing himself again. The Iron Curtain speech in 1946, warning about the Soviets, writing his massive history of the war, which won him the Nobel Prize for Literature.
Always moving forward, always finding a new stage. It really drives home that point. Failure is an event, not a person.
That's a key lesson from his life, definitely. Setbacks can be the foundation for what comes next.
Okay, so let's try and crystallize this. After immersing ourselves in this epic story via The Last Lion, what are the core takeaways for someone listening today?
It really shows how deep currents shape history, doesn't it? And how individual character matters profoundly.
We always aim for three key insights. What's the first?
I'd say the first is an emotional insight. That deep driving force was arguably the unresolved relationship with his father. That lifelong quest for approval, for recognition. It fueled his immense ambition. It shows how personal wounds can, sometimes, become the engine for extraordinary achievements.
That makes sense. The personal driving the historical. What about intellectually?
An intellectual insight. Okay. His real superpower was that historical imagination. His ability to see current events not in isolation, but as part of a long historical continuum, especially the centuries-long struggle against tyranny in Europe, it gave him a strategic clarity others lacked.
Seeing the bigger picture, the deeper pattern. Okay. Got it. And finally, something universal.
A universal insight. True strength isn't about being flawless. It's about mastering your own contradictions. Churchill was a warrior and a writer, deeply romantic and brutally realistic, prone to depression and fiercely optimistic. He contained multitudes. His life suggests that embracing complexity, not shying away from it, is key to resilience and maybe even greatness.
Embracing the complexity, that's powerful. And a final thought to leave people with. Churchill's most vital warnings came when he was most isolated, most ignored.
Right, when he was saying the things nobody wanted to hear.
So maybe ask yourself, what unpopular conviction are you holding on to right now? What truth, maybe uncomfortable, are you seeing or speaking? It might just be the essential insight needed for whatever crisis comes next. What quiet work, what preparation are you doing now that your own future might demand? Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.